Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film creator and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with all those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the actors, the writers, the cinematographers, production designers, film editors, sound mixers, sound designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen, costume designers, production designers, you name it, we talk to them all. And we're like heading into award season here. So I'm looking forward to doing a lot of talking with some potential nominees for Golden Globes, Academy Awards, and all of the Guild Awards that you find during this season. So we'll see what happens with that in the next coming months. But right now, I'm still doing a lot of talking and a lot of watching. So this weekend alone, from Friday through Sunday, I ended up binging 8 hours of a phenomenal TV show that is on, it's either HBO or Max. I binged all 8 hours of The Penguin. I am obsessed with this show. I love this show. I'm very excited. I'm going to be speaking with executive producer and one of the directors, Craig Zobel, later this week. If you haven't seen the show yet, see it. The show airs on Wednesdays. What day is it? Fridays. An episode a week. And boy, oh boy, you aren't going to believe what's coming down the pike on this one. For those of you that are already watching, if you haven't started watching, I highly encourage you. Colin Farrell stars as the Penguin. And you've got to see it to believe it. Just, we're talking Emmy Award next year. Emmy Award, hands down. Just a fantastic series. But in addition to 8 hours of The Penguin, I also then watched 16 feature films. Wow. It's interesting to see the films that are coming out, the small little independent films that are coming out. I watched several films that have deaf characters as main characters and plot points in the films. One is a thriller. It's an action thriller. Another one is an absolutely phenomenal family film called Rally Caps. It is out there floating around on digital. If you see it, I'm going to be putting a review out on it. But it is terrific. It is so wonderful. So families out there, parents, look for this. One of the players is deaf. He had cochlear implants. So then deafness is written in to the storyline. And it's just so well done. We've got spooky films galore. We're going to talk about one of them today, which is Treasure Trackers. Drew Garcia and Nate Garcia, co-directors, co-editors, co-cinematographers, are going to be joining me at the midpoint of the show today to talk about this spooky-ooky adventure family film again. Which is so much fun. And later this week, you're going to go to behindthelensonline.net and you're going to find my exclusive interview with director David Henry. Now, most of you know him for his acting in series like Wizards of Waverly Place, or for his recent turn as a teenage Ron Reagan in the biopic Reagan. David is absolutely charming, very talented as a director. And his film, Monster Summer, is coming out this Friday. And it's another spooky Halloween kind of film with lots of kids. Lots of kid films happening, spooky films happening. But some great themes are popping up in this all of these films from a very diverse cross-section. Some of the films I just watched this weekend were submitted to me directly by filmmakers themselves that don't have distribution yet. Some are self-distributing. Others are from more mainstream. Later coming up, you're going to be seeing my interviews pop up and hearing them pop up on some great films like Baron's Cove, with, I mean, just a twisty, turny thriller again. Some great thrillers are popping up. But next week, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with two of the funniest guys around when they get together, Paul Reiser and Colm Meaney, talking about their brand new film together, The Problem with People. And anyone that knows me knows, how can I pass up a film called The Problem with People? But today, in addition to another great film that is now in theaters, there are two films that hit theaters on Friday. One is Amber Alert, which is the most fantastic original spin on ride shares. We've seen horror ones, we've seen bizarre ones, we've seen interesting ones, but this one really brings into, from Carrie Bellessa, it takes into account a child is kidnapped and a rideshare driver and his passenger get involved in the pursuit to track this little girl down who's been kidnapped after they see the vehicle that they think is the kidnappers. It will have you on the edge of your seat. My interview with Carrie, it's wonderful. That is actually, I just have to hit publish on the computer when I go home and that'll be up. But first, I'm kicking off today's show with one of my favorite films of the year. It is a powerhouse, award-worthy on multiple levels, most notably for Kate Winslet in her performance as the acclaimed photographer Lee Miller, an American war correspondent, essentially for Vogue magazine, and photographer. Lee Miller, everybody has talked about in terms of female photographers in the past, Margaret Bourke White. And yes, Margaret Bourke White has done some incredible photographs. But what sets Lee Miller apart from White is that Lee's photographs really capture humanity, the fragility of life, and the human experience. And she was no holds barred. She started her career as a model, then moved into photography. But it was light and bright pre-war, and then the war hit, and she had to do something. So she did what she knew best. She looked through the lens of her Rolleiflex camera and told story after story after story through her pictures of what was happening in the war, in the heat of the war, inside Germany, inside concentration camps with piles of dead bodies. Her pictures are, once you see them, they are unforgettable. Many of her most iconic images have been recreated in the film Lee, directed by one of my favorite cinematographers, the award-winning cinematographer Ellen Curris. This is her second film, narrative feature film, her first being The Betrayal back in 2008. That was a documentary. So this is her first narrative feature. She, no holds barred, she goes for broke. Her collaboration with Kate Winslet is amazing. Amazing. And The cast overall is fantastic. In addition to Kate Winslet, Alexander Sarsgaard plays her husband, Roland Penrose. Andy Samberg plays Davy Sherman, a Life magazine photographer who pretty much partnered up with Lee. And the two of them ventured into war-torn Europe, capturing amazing images, telling powerful stories. Andrea Riseborough played Audrey Winters, the editor of Vogue. Samuel Barnett as Cecil Beaton is hilarious. He adds a real lightness. You always need a lightness. The film, the cinematographer is Powell Edelman, whose work, he manipulates light in this film almost to the point of being able to feel it and touch it. There is so much visual texture in Powell's work. He's probably best known for his works working with Roman Polanski. Powell was cinematographer on The Pianist, Ghost Rider, which I love, Venus in Fur. Just outstanding. And between he and Ellen, the work that they did in recreating some of Lee Miller's most spectacular photos, including Lee's self-portrait in Hitler's bathtub, actual bathtub. And they recreated that by measurement, tile, everything. It is astounding. The sound is impeccable. Sound designer, Jimmy Boyle, same sound designer on Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I'm going to be talking to Jimmy, hopefully later this week. The score, one of my faves, Alexander Desplat. Edited by Michael Nielsen, just on every level. This is a powerhouse of a film. It is not a biopic because it only picks out a chapter in Lee Miller's life. And something that Ellen kept in mind as she was directing, as she was crafting this film, at all times, it's a question that she would always ask directors as a cinematographer. What is the point of view? And she asked herself that with this film. And believe me, she stays in Lee Miller's, in the point of view. And that is Lee Miller's point of view. Astounding film. Take a listen to my exclusive interview with director Ellen Curris talking about Lee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Debbie. How are you?
I'm so thrilled to get to speak with you. I am such an admirer of your work as a cinematographer, all the television episodes that you've done, and even your first directorial, your co-directing documentary for The Betrayal, oh, so many years ago. So to get to see you now step into your first feature narrative directorial, and with a film like Lee, I am thrilled to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Debbie. I really appreciate it. Yes, and it's an honor to be here. You know, I feel really privileged because, you know, as everybody knows, you know, to get a film done is a miracle. And, you know, this film was a challenge to, you yeah. know, to make and to get done. It was the process over a number of years. And, you know, it was started out as the brainstorm of Kate Winslet, you know, who had bought a table that belonged to Lee Miller's sister-in-law. So, you know, we can imagine who was sitting at that table, all the journalists, you know, the whole gang. So anyway, it's a real pleasure to be here.
A pleasure to watch Lee. What you have done, Ellen, is so incredible. It is so emotional. You've got a really dynamic story structure to work with. The book ending is fabulous, set in the form of a question and answer. Interviewing mom, interviewing Lee, and how she's very reticent. She doesn't want to discuss her past. But then we go into, and the visual grammar that you have crafted with Pavel, another one whose work I am just so in love with, speaks volumes. As you take us through, you shape the tone visually with the days in Paris that are light and carefree and sunny and bright. And then we slowly get darker and more claustrophobic with tighter framing. The lensing is just impeccable. The lighting is
stunning, especially when we get into some of the hotels and where the military is that Lee and Davy are trying to catch up with. And then you recreate some of Lee's most iconic images. The only other person I've seen do this to such great result is Sean McNamara and what he just did with Reagan, very similarly with some iconic images or portraitures. And you do that here with Lee's photographs. Where do you even start breaking this down from a visual and tonal standpoint?
Well, you know, having been a cinematographer for many years, one of the key questions I would ask directors, and the one that I ask myself as a director, is what is the point of view of this film? And, you know, through what lens do we want to tell this story? And so, you know, as a director, a very privileged place to be able to dictate that and to be able to, you know, shape and decide that. And of course, in concert with Paul Wittleman, who is the DP, you know, I spoke to him much about, you know, creating a POV where we're not looking at Lee, we're mm-hmm. not watching her, you know, objectifying her, because she was long objectified in her own life as a model and, you know, as a subject of many photographs by her father when she was a child. So I knew that we wanted to bring the story closer to her, so that not only with the visuals, but with the sound, with the production design, that everything would go into creating the tone and the world in which Lee Miller lived. And that's the thing about the distinguishing thing about being only the cinematographer versus being the director, where I'm able to, you know, look at the locations, decide on the locations in the director's scout to say, you know, I need a location that's going to be meaningful to this scene, not only just a location, but what's going to work for the scene. For example, when they go into the heart of darkness, when they cross over into Germany, mm-hmm. you know, I saw many location photos that were about just, you know, fences or so-called borders, and I'm like, no, this has to feel like they're going into the heart of darkness.
Yeah.
The landscape is unknown. So that, to me, the story always tells me, you know, what the elements are going to be, you know, how to put the elements together in terms of the tone, in terms of the look. So I also wanted it to go from being light in the late 30s when we start out the film, we're unsuspecting that war is on the cusp.
Right.
You know, it's light, you know, the colors are vibrant, life is free, you know, people, you know, this surrealist group that get together, you know, have a light tone to them. They, you know, they're taking off their shirts and, you know, everybody is unsuspecting of what's to happen around the corner. So we show that, and we feel that with the production design, with the costume design, with the tone, with the sound, with the music. And then we gradually go more and more into the darkness, into the heart of darkness. And we see what ends up happening in the war. So, you know, it's great to be able to talk to Pavel about how to do that with the camera and with the look of the film later on in post.
The look of the film is just stunning, and you really establish a solid visual tonal bandwidth that takes us through eras and places. And I think one of the most powerful segments that you have, besides Hitler's bathtub recreation, which is just gobsmackingly perfect, going into the cattle cars. It's not just Lee and Davy outside just peeking in the door of the cattle cars with bodies, hundreds of bodies, but it's actually Lee getting up inside, and the camera goes with her, so we are there, and we're experiencing that negative space in the darkness. And that is so powerful, Ellen, just so powerful. that segment really blew my mind, I have to tell you.
It goes to show you Lee's absolute drive and determination to be unafraid to tell the story and to get up there in that car was to see things from a different point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what Lee was about. She wanted to see things from a different point of view. She wanted to see what was happening on the outside of the frame of the combat, what was happening to people around the war, what was happening to the women who were part of the war effort, you know, what was happening around it. And that is so much about when we get into that train car that I knew we wanted to put the camera up there with her, to be with her, so that we're not watching her do it. And so, you know, it's really important for the resonance of the emotional moment, the emotional moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you definitely succeed. And not just that instance, but others as well. Because it feels like, to borrow from Walter Cronkite, you are there. I felt like I was right there with Lee, with her POV of what she was seeing. And it's very difficult to achieve that, but you do that so beautifully. And you brought up a very important, two very important elements. One is Gemma Jackson's production design. Somebody better start an awards campaign for her work, because I got to tell you, it is so immersive. It is so stunning. The contrast, the recreations, absolutely astounding. And hand in hand with everything that is often so overlooked is the sound. You got Jimmy Boyle, who's one sound designer. What you give us is this great cacophonic mix of battle and silence, going from a single crunch of a footstep to a wafting breeze in Paris. It is an amazingly immersive oral experience. What was it like working with Jimmy and the sound team on this to get this fully sensory experience?
Well, Jimmy was completely on board to think about sound as metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really important. And I'm all about using the elements of film language to create meaning. And, you know, he and I talked extensively about that. And I said to Jimmy, I said, for example, in the beginning, when we are with Lee running through the battlefield, I want to background the battlefield sound, and I want to hear her heartbeat, and I want to hear her breathing, and I want to really feel like I'm with her, and that sets up the tone of the film, where, you know, we're foregrounding what would be unexpected, and backgrounding all of those explosions. And that's where sound can be used creatively to create metaphor and take the audience to a certain place. So that became our coda throughout the whole film of how we use the sound effects and whether we pull back on certain sound effects or take them out or whether we lay them in.
Mm-hmm. I am always just so impressed with excellent sound design, sound mixing, and you got Jimmy and Formosa. That's one of the best out there. So you lucked out here. You lucked out on many levels here, Ellen, with your cast, with Powell, with Mikel as your editor, and Gemma's production design. Did you and Gemma storyboard this out along with Powell? How did you go about with this production design? Because it is so historically specific. Particularly Hitler's bathtub and apartment.
Well, I spoke to Gemma extensively about what we were going to do for this. And she and I sat down and spent many, many hours in her apartment going through pictures, going through references, looking at movies. And the thing about Gemma is that, you know, she is very specific, which was great. And also just has a great mind for looking at something which is out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we were looking for St. Malo, and the location for St. Malo, which is in the north of France, which is on the coast, which is very close to where D-Day happens. Saint-Malo, you know, the it's a walled city. It's a medieval city. So where are we going to find that? We couldn't find that in Hungary, where we were primarily shooting, nor could we find it really literally in Croatia. But Gemma was out scouting. I happened to get COVID, believe it or not. COVID after, you know, going through so much production in New York, and all of a sudden I got COVID, so I was in the hotel for 5 days while we were in Croatia scouting, director scouting. And Gemma happened to stumble upon this 5-star hotel that had been bombed in the Bosnian War, with the Bosnian-Croatian War.
Mm-hmm.
And it was overgrown, but the thing was, it was 19th century architecture, because I had shown Gemma the Saint-Malo and this square across from this castle where a lot of the war had taken place in Saint-Malo, these were 19th century buildings, right, that were stuck in the middle of a medieval town. So I said to Gemma, wow, look at that. That's actually the hotel where she was camped out, you know, where she was taking the photographs, not where she was staying. So we were being historically accurate at the same time. So she finds this hotel and she texts me and she says, you're not going to believe this, but you've got to come and see this. So, you know, I had to wait out my 5 days and immediately jumped on in the van and went to go see this location. And I just thought, Gemma, this is an amazing idea. This is perfect. You know, if we can do it, because we had to clear out all of this vegetation. But the fact that she had the imagination to do it was great. And then she and I shaped it after that. You know, it's like, what kind of cars are we going to put there? What are we going to do? What's going to be bombed out? What do we use? You know, what can we put here? So she and I worked very closely together to create that space. And of course, you know, she had a great art director and a great set dresser that we worked with. So, you know, Gemma and I worked very closely together, and I just admire her tenacity and determination to, you know, make this film be not only authentic and historically accurate in the spirit of the truth, but also really visually engaging.
The same thing with
Marion Cotillard at the very, you know, after the war, when Lee comes upon her in that room. So we had to shoot that scene in Croatia because of the schedule. And we were looking all over Dubrovnik, where we shot. And so, you know, Gemma was out looking for locations, and she again says to me, you know, there's this room. I'm not sure if it's going to work, but let's take a look. And I walked in, and I was like, Gemma, perfect. You know, I can imagine how we're going to do this. So she and I, of course, worked very closely on the set design and how it was going to be set up so that, you know, it became a metaphor for the shattered life of Solange.
Mm-hmm. How difficult was the...
Long answers, Debbie.
Oh, I love your aunt Ellen. I love it. As I told them earlier today, I said, I could talk to you for 30, 40, 50 minutes about this film. There's so much. But how challenging was putting this cast together? Obviously, you've got Kate, which is the linchpin and the heartbeat of the casting. But who you surround her with is amazing. I have never seen Andy Samberg better than he is here as Davy. Andrea Riseborough, unrecognizable. I had no clue that was Andrea as Audrey Winters. Alexander as Roland Penrose. I love the contrast between Lee and Roland, because she's down, dirty, gritty. She's got dirt under her nails. And he is always so well kept, so clean, and that striking contrast really, it's analogous to the world and how it started out so bright and clean, shiny and sunny like a new penny, and turned into dirt, but yet the worlds fit together. So I'm curious how challenging this casting was.
Well, interestingly, when Kate Winslet and I first talked about the film, we talked about dirt. I mean, it was, we talk about dirt under the fingernails, and how in some films, you know, you see people who've been part of war and they come out and they look pristine.
So yes.
Dirt is kind of like our guiding principle. But, Kate was always going to be Lee Miller because she was the one who approached Anthony Penrose about doing the film. And so she always saw herself as Lee Miller. So when she asked me to do the project as a director, you know, of course, you know, I always thought that she was Lee Miller anyway, because years before, I always said to her, you look like Lee Miller.
She does.
And she has an uncanny resemblance to her, not only in looks, but also in drive and tenacity and that kind of fierceness. But the rest of the cast was just incredible. We have an amazing, gifted cast. Marion Cotillard as Solange was the first person I thought of when I read the script. You know, I was like, oh my God, Marion, she's such a gifted actor. But, you know, the cast came together as part of conversations between myself and Kate Winslet about who we thought could play those roles. And Andy Samberg was the brainstorm, the out-of-the-box brainstorm of one of the writers, Marion Chu, who suggested, what about Andy Samberg? And we both was like, whoa. We looked at each other like, yeah, what about Andy Samberg? You know, he is normally a comedian, mm-hmm. but he was able to step outside of his genre to be David E. Sherman in a way that was, had both, you know, comedy in embedded in him, but also incredible emotional resonance.
Yeah.
You know, it's unusual for an actor to step outside of the genre in quite the way that he did. But, you know, to Andy's huge talent and range as an actor, you know, he really took this on as a role. And he, you know, forms part of the emotional core of the story. Alexander Skarsgård is unbelievable. I mean, Alexander, such a pro and so engaging and so charming as Roland Penrose. And also took on that the English accent, an English aristocratic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Alexander is Swedish, but he completely took on that accent in a way that he was able to own it, and really became Roland Penrose. And Andrea Weisbrot came to the project because Kate has always been an admirer of Andrea Weisbrot. And she said today, she goes, we should look at Andrea Weisbrot for Audrey Wizard. And I thought, wow, you know, that's a great idea. She was someone that wasn't, you know, we was not extremely well known. But now we know her, you know, for all of her work that she's done in the past few years, just been exceptional.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Ellen, this has been an absolute thrill to get to speak with you, and I hope we get to do it again in the future.
Thank you so much, Debbie. Take care, and thank you again for taking the time.
And that was my exclusive interview with director Ellen Kuras talking about Lee. See it. I can't encourage you enough. In the vernacular of my one brother, who likes to say, is this a full-price movie? Is it a matinee-price movie? It is a wait-for-cable movie, at-home viewing, or wait until it's on regular TV and chop to heck with commercials. This is a full-price nighttime feature. Actually, anytime. The movie is that good. Kate Winslet is just riveting. The film is engrossing. It is enthralling, it is shocking, it is disturbing, and it will move you to tears at multiple moments. And this interview with Ellen gives you just some of the insight into her process of making this film. So that is my big pitch for Lee, one of my favorites of the year. And now we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about ooky, spooky, treasure-hunting teens with, and Pam's bringing them live now, We've got Drew Garcia and Nate Garcia, co-directors, editors, and cinematographers of the wonderful family film Treasure Trackers. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hey, how's it going?
It's going. It's going. All right, who's who so I can tell by your voice? Drew, where are you?
This is Drew. And this is Nate. We probably sound similar. I mean, we are brothers, so we sound similar.
Well, I don't sound like my brothers or my sister, thank God. But, okay, you guys do sound a lot alike.
What do you got against your siblings? What's going on?
Okay, my brothers are fine. The other one, forget about.
I'm going to find him. I'm going to send him this clip and be like, man.
Nothing I won't say to their
this
faces.
This is the real reason we're doing this interview. This is an intervention for you and your siblings.
This is going to turn into a Maury Povich show real quick. Okay.
Yeah.
Forget Treasure Trackers. Let's talk about your family dynamic.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, we've got family dynamics happening in Treasure Trackers.
We do.
We do.
This is such an entertaining film. It is such a fun film. And your casting is great. The story is great. We've got three junior high, middle school kids. One of which, Leah, has just been plopped down in Carterville by her father, and she's left with her aunt and uncle, who she barely remembers, and there's nothing to do and nowhere to go. But she goes to school, and she meets Tessa and Marshy. They become friends, in large part thanks to quirky school teacher, quirky librarian, and every school has them. In this case, it's Mr. Bigsby, and Leah finds out about the legend of Carterville and the Carterville and the gold. So, of course, that's all you need. And she, you know, and for Leah, her big thing is, you know, a metal detector. Best gift her dad ever gave her, a metal detector, and she can walk around the yard and or wherever and use her metal detector. Not that that helps much in the hunt for the Carterville gold. As you so beautifully show us, we've got ravens, we've got witches, we've got all kinds of stuff happening here. And it's so much fun. I've only watched the film twice. I just love it. So
really? That's awesome.
How did this film even make its way to the two of you? And I have to say, I think this is the perfect film for two brothers, for the two of you as brothers to be working on together.
The long story short version is that Nate and I actually really like making these kinds of movies. It's not just a job for us. And so way back in 2017, we had made a short film called Hero that just kind of lived on YouTube, and it was a similar vibe to Treasure Trackers, actually, and it kind of started this ensemble cast of kids. And the producers for Treasure Trackers are looking for directors with this kind of sensibility, and they happened upon our film, and the rest is history, I guess.
Wow. But this is a great sensibility, and what I have found over the years is that this is a sensibility that we've seen less and less of, but within the past, I'd say year, maybe year and a half, I'm starting to see more of your sensibility start popping up in films.
I think that's true. I mean, probably because a lot of the people who are now able to direct, people in their 30s and 40s, grew up with these kinds of movies and like them and love them. I mean, we grew up with, like Drew said, a lot of the old Disney films that were live action,
mm-hmm.
a lot of movies like Homeward Bound, Angels in the Outfield, these sort of family-focused movies that are entertaining and fun and just sort of, you know, their older sensibility. And, yeah, they went out of vogue for a while, but I'm excited to see that they're coming back as well.
Yeah, and I mentioned...
They're very earnest movies, aren't they? They're not cynical.
Yeah, sincere.
No, they're very sincere. They're very heartwarming, and they do. They give you, for me, you know, I was born in the 50s. So growing up in the 60s, Disney, that was the way to go. But it's very, films like Treasure Trackers also have a very nostalgic bent to them. You mentioned Angels in the Outfield. I was more familiar with the original black and white Angels in the Outfield than the later version. But that same gentility, that same spirit of fun and caring and friendship was there in both versions. So I'm so happy to, you know, see a film like Treasure Trackers. I mean, later in the week, David Henry has a film, Monster Summer. Same kind of sensibility as the two of you.
That's awesome.
And I love that as well. But so I'm so thrilled that you guys were discovered and tapped to make Treasure Trackers. Now, once you got the nod and said, okay, boys, what can you do? How do you start breaking down a film like this? And did you always intend to co-direct, co-edit, and do co-lighting and lensing on this one?
That's a good question. So, it is a big thing to tackle, and I wouldn't say that we were necessarily thinking about doing all three of the major jobs of directing, cinematography, and editing. But it kind of just, as we talked about the way we were going to tackle the project, we have kind of created a whole ecosystem of how we work over the years. And it just, as we started thinking about the visuals and the way we would actually do this, it seemed like, okay, we can either try to bring somebody else into this process and give them a crash course on how we're going to try to make this movie, or we could just do it ourselves. And so I think somewhere in the middle of pre-production, we actually pitched ourselves to shoot it as well. And it felt very comfortable for us to work that way. So that was fun. But
I think another factor was just, where are the resources going? You know, Drew and I realized early on that if we take on more, that frees up some of the budget to do something that we both put a lot of focus on, which is the score. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to bring in the composer, Robin Hoffman. We've worked with him before, and get a live orchestra. And really, for a movie this size, it's not done.
Right.
It's going to be digital orchestration. So we were able to, by taking more on, free up enough budget to make that happen. And we're really proud of that.
I will say, I was going to get into the score later, but let's talk score, because this score, it's very cinematic. And I love the fact that it is orchestral and you can hear it in the instrumentation and how well that instrumentation and the orchestral beats play out with the beats of the story. You feel the tension. You feel the fear. You feel the calm. It's such a beautiful part of this film that really also helps fuel that nostalgic feeling of days gone by, when everything was done with full composure, with composition and a full orchestra.
We had our composer, Robin Hoffman. He was on board with that short film we made in 2017. So it was a natural extension to just bring him on board to make a score for this. Because Nate and I really feel strongly that the composer is as important a performer as the lead actor of the film. At least in the way that we make movies. And so there, Robin, in this case, he's in the saddle with us, telling this story. And the fascinating thing is to put these images on screen, hand them over to him, and then see the way that the images impact him and all of the little nuances he's picking up thematically that he's then translating into music.
Mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's a wonderful score, guys.
Well, we just really believe, you know, like you said, this is our style. We just feel you can't separate the two. Movies are musical at their core, and there's a rhythm to them. Mm-hmm. And so by pulling in the composer earlier on, you have a much better result because everything's more aligned.
Yeah, it always works better if the composer is there early, rather than the film is done and it gets handed off to a composer and he gets told, you have 2 weeks.
Right.
To give us a score.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a little anecdote that kind of is right in line with what you're asking, which is the very beginning of the movie wasn't as it was on the page. We actually pitched the producers to do a little bit more storytelling visually. And one of the ideas that Nate had was to have this character of Grandma Elise actually humming a tune that we wanted to become kind of the main witch's theme. So that meant that we needed to actually work with Robin to come up with that theme before we'd even shot. So that was kind of a fun process.
And I love the fact that we do hear her humming that theme quite often. And when she does, when Grandma Elise does this, she has a little smile on her face. One of those all-knowing grandmom smiles. It speaks volumes. That she knows something.
Leia, it's kind of a classic thing to go in kids' movies. You know, there's this older person. You see it in, like, the Narnia adaptations where the adult has been to Narnia and they know what's about to happen, you know. So it's kind of a nod to that.
Well, and we don't just have our three wonderful protagonists of Leia, Tessa, and Marshy, you know, trying to find this gold and solve the riddle of Silas Carter after his book, his diary, is stolen from the glass showcase in the school library. This is what really kicks things off here. And the diary must be found. But by the same token, we have the older bad teens that seem to be perpetrating things every year because they want to find the gold. But what they seem to forget is that there's a curse on the gold. And if you find it and if you take it, bad things might happen. But when you're a bad teen, you don't care about being bad. Obviously. But so you pit these two groups of kids together. And what is really interesting here is not only your visuals, the visuals are so engaging, but also the fact that you keep us in the POV of not only Leia, but also Tessa and Marshy as a collective group. We stay in their POV, but they also, they're very cerebral. They're intelligent. They think their way through things, through clues and through steps on their hunt. And I love the fact that you stuck with that and you show us that to the point of touching a brain, a fake brain, but a supernatural brain. So we get it. They're not dumb kids. They're very smart kids, and they're thinking their way through a situation. And that is really refreshing to see.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and I you know, this is a big shout out there to the writer, Harris Kaufman, who wrote us a great script to direct. And you could just tell that he was very much approaching it from the standpoint of wanting it to be kind of a nod to some of these fun movies like National Treasure, where you're piecing together clues like you said, that scene where it all culminates in the witch's cabin and they're solving those riddles was kind of a fun way to, I guess, have some of that same nostalgia for, again, a lot of these throwback movies like National Treasure. And he did a great job giving us that script.
Yeah, and some of the old book series like The Boxcar Kids or Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys, you know.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the fact that, you know, the riddles in the witch's cabin, the riddles, it made you immediately think of math class. If you have 7 apples, 6 oranges, 1 banana, how many trains does it take to move them? when the riddles keep getting posed, and right away it made me think of those stupid word problems in math class. And you have to think them out and realize what you throw away and what actually you need to pay attention to. And that's, and watching them, that's what they do. And this is also kudos to your three main actors, to Charity Rose as Leah, Emilia Salazar as Tessa, and Sean Jay as Marshy. The three of them are so good, their facial expressiveness and their cohesiveness. You believe that they became fast friends. Talk to me about selecting them, casting them, and working with them to get such a great on-screen friendship happening so quickly.
Oh, man, we went through a lot of auditions. And so to find them, you know, it was just like finding a needle in a haystack. There's just so many auditions that come through. And we saw them, we knew that we had, you know, a lot of special kids. And I think their chemistry on set and on screen was fantastic. They were so easy to work with. And I think that each of them are special in their own right. Charity is just fantastic as the lead. I mean, she's just magnetic.
Truly. Was there a particular order?
I think they were actually fast friends just the second we got them together. They hit it off. And I remember that the first day that we had rehearsal with them, we all ended up staying at one of the same hotels. And I walked by the laundry room, and the three kids on that very first night were there studying their lines. And it was clear to see that they were already hitting it off. And I think that chemistry really found its way onto the screen.
Wow. Oh, their chemistry on screen is great. Really great. And they do. They become fast friends very quickly once they first meet in school and once Leia does something to kind of help Marshy out when he's being bullied. And that's you don't shy away from things like bullying in this film. You don't shy away from criminal elements of why you should not do these bad things, and you will get arrested for it. You incur friendship, bravery. You really have very definitive themes happening here. And you really show us that, not just in dialogue, but in performance and also in your visual grammar. And your visual grammar is really beautiful here. I'm curious what your thoughts were, what your approach was to developing not just the look of the film, but the emotional tonal bandwidth that you get with your visuals. Because you really make great use of framing in terms of widening, coming in closer on your two shots, which a bulk of this film is on is two shots because the kids are together. But I'm curious about your approach to developing that visual grammar here.
Yeah, we certainly have so many wonderful influences to talk about some of those movies we grew up with. Spielberg is the classic example of just a master visual storyteller. And you look at the way that he moves the camera and goes from one setup to another without ever having to cut, with maybe a little bit of coverage to make sure you're covered in the edit. So we approached it somewhat with that mentality. But another way that we maybe differentiate ourselves from that sort of strictly shooting just a moving master is we do shoot for the edit. Mm-hmm. And we think the edit is one of the most important components, if not the most important component, of actually making the tone of the film. So we make sure that we shoot a lot of coverage, but every shot is intentional, is moving with intention, hopefully. At least the intention that we're going for, and giving ourselves enough material to work with in post so that we can actually sit with it and, you know, craft something that actually has the rhythm that the scene actually needs, because it can be very difficult to get that rhythm exactly right on set. You've got all these moving pieces. And when you actually put all that stuff in the edit, that's where you can start to fine tune and make the thing actually move at the right rhythm.
Now, where did you film this? What was your location for this one?
This is filmed in Knoxville, Tennessee. kind of see. It was just a beautiful, you know, anywhere you pointed the camera was going to look great.
Yeah. Oh, the location is stunning. And this is something also that I love, that we get to see the greenery. We get to see the woods. Woods always make things a little spookier and a lot more fun because you're wondering if somebody's going to trip over a log. But we've got camping. So you really take advantage of the visuals that your location provided you. Was it difficult to find this location?
Well, it's always difficult.
When we were first talking to the
scouting, yeah.
Go ahead, Nate.
But we just found, man, the people of Knoxville were so helpful. I mean, they showed us so many spots that were great, publicly available, but also private land. And everyone was so helpful. So, yes, it's always a challenge to find the right location, but everyone there made it a lot easier.
Now, did you?
And I would say probably one of the most enjoyable parts of the process for us, Nate, was in the location scouting. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, 100%. I mean, just going out, seeing all the different towns. There's been some other projects that Drew and I both love. For instance, October Sky was shot down there.
Oh.
And we love that movie. And so we got to see where that was shot. And it was cool, you know, to feel like we got to be part of this film history there.
Well, now part of that film history, and I've got to ask you, were you actually shooting in caves?
Yeah. There's a cave right there in Knoxville within the city limits called the Cherokee Caverns. And the city of Knoxville was super helpful in giving us lists of potential locations. And so we knew that the climax of this movie is going to be taking place in this cave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't have $200 million to build a set that big. So we had to try to find something that would actually work. And when we got to the location and went down inside, we were blown away. It's such a cool spot. And they actually have events there. I think they do. They watch like the Goonies there every year. And so it was such a cool and inspiring location. In fact, just last week, we were all in Tennessee for the premiere of the movie, and our composer came over from Berlin, and that was one of the first places we took him to see, was that
cave,
because it was just such a cool location.
Wow. Now, shooting in a cave like that, because, you know, you've got different areas in the cave that you go through. When we get the stalagmites, stalactites, we get everything, and Marshy gives us a little history, little geological lessons as to which is which and what is what as we're going into the caves, which I thought was really nice. And then you also bring in special effects in there at some point. But I'm curious, when you're in shooting, how logistically challenging was that for you in terms of equipment, lighting, cameras, generators, in order to shoot inside the caverns?
Well, that was challenging. I was challenging for a lot of reasons, but one of the major ones is we initially had 2 days scheduled to shoot that, and then because a huge storm front was coming in, so the whole cave was going to flood if we stayed in there. So we had to shoot that in 1 day, and I think that was the biggest challenge. Is we had 100 and how many shots, Drew?
It was 120 shots.
120 shots in a day. In a cave, you know, with a lot of lighting set up. So that was super challenging to get done, and it was a long day.
Wow.
Yeah, because when you're in a cave, you don't have the aid of any natural light, so every single shot has to be lit.
Yeah.
And that definitely adds to the challenge. And you also don't want to be running your generators inside the cave, so you're running your stingers all the way from outside the cave. Another challenge is that the walkie-talkies don't work anymore down in the caves. So communication becomes a lot more difficult, especially on a scene that's that big. It has so many moving parts to it. So that was a really challenging sequence, but it was also the most well-planned sequence. Nate and I were down in that cave for probably 20 or 30 hours before we ever even got on set with mm-hmm. the rest of the team, planning out meticulously where every shot would be. And we actually shot the whole thing in advance on my iPhone, edited mm-hmm. it together so we knew exactly how it would piece together. And that was definitely very, very helpful.
Now, what cameras were you using in there? And were you doing Steadicam? Were you doing handheld? Or did you bring in sticks or dolly?
We shot the whole movie on a couple of Canon C300 Mark III's. and one C70 was our C camera. And we primarily shot on a tripod with a little device on the top of it that's called a C-pan arm. It's kind of like a slider on steroids. So you don't have to lay down dolly track this way. You can actually get that trucking or dolly motion. You can also get kind of a booming motion as well, all with a couple twists of some knobs. So that was helpful. We did have a gimbal that we used on a few shots, but because of the pace that we were having to work, gimbals could just be really cumbersome and take time to balance and that sort of thing. So yeah, we were mostly on the contraption I just described, but if we were pressed for time, I would typically just grab the camera off the tripod and we would just do a rolling take, and I would just go in and get all the different inserts and everything all in one take so that we could make sure we had the coverage that we needed. So that was kind of our last resort, but there was a fair amount of handheld in that cave sequence. And I think it actually still lent itself to the kind of energy that scene needed anyway.
Well, because you really want fear, you want tension, and you've got some great shots as we're each sliding, tiptoeing on this tiny little ledge. And I kept thinking, somebody's going to slip off there. Somebody's going to fall. Somebody's going to slip. Somebody's going to fall. As, they're trying to, like, relocate something. And you really built up tension. And going in on the close-ups, and you don't use a lot of close-ups in this film, but when you go in close on ECUs, such as feet on rock or shale, it's very powerful because of your judicious use and how well you did shoot what you used. I'm very impressed with the in-cave shooting, guys. Very impressed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At what stage did you turn this over for special effects for lava and things like that? And some mystical things that happen. It is Halloween, after all. You must have some mysticism.
Well, we edited the movie. So we finished in late May, and we started editing the movie right away when we got back to Idaho, where we're from. And Drew started working with Mark right away to walk through those shots. And so I think we started working on visual effects in June and wrapped those up in maybe December, Drew.
Yeah, it took quite a while. And I do also want to take a moment to give a shout out to Mark Maiko, our visual effects supervisor, who did pretty much all of that work just on his own, which is a monumental task. And he was somebody that we found on YouTube who was doing tutorials in After Effects and just had so much obvious skill that when we reached out to him to see if he would come on board of the project, he was all in. And he blew us away. Like, for example, there's a shot earlier on in the movie where there's a statue out in front of the school. And we're thinking, okay, this is this 15-foot-tall granite statue. How are we going to do this within our budget? And the solution we came up with, that we were going to actually 3D scan with LiDAR our two actors who played the Silas and Bob Carter. We're going to 3D scan them and then convert that into a 3D object, texture it, and then motion track that right into the scene. And I think that most people would look at that shot and not even realize that statue is not there at all. And that's a huge testament to Mark's skill.
Wow. Wow. And you don't go overboard with your effects when we get into the nitty gritty of stuff. And I really appreciate that, because you so easily could have gone really heavy into visual effects on this one. Anytime you get a movie like this, you can really push it. But then it becomes, I think, kind of cartoony. And you definitely were not going for cartoony here. I can tell that. You were.
Well, one of the things that we love about those old movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark, they were really in Tunisia. They were really out there having an adventure themselves in the making of it. And that's important to us. As cool as all this technology is, it's just not as exciting to just go sit on the volume for 3 months. And we would rather get out there in the woods and in the caves and make movies the old-fashioned way. And it's, I think the difference is obvious on screen as well.
Yeah, you feel as an audience still when you watch a movie, if something's shot on location versus on a stage, you feel the difference and your eye can tell. And so in this, we wanted to, and we got fortunate with shooting in Knoxville. We could shoot on location a lot, and you feel like this is a real world the characters are in.
Yeah. Oh, I believed it 1,000%. And, you know, live is always better than Memorex, let me tell you. So, no, just so beautifully done. Now, I'm curious for each of you, what did you learn about yourselves as filmmakers? Because this is the first narrative feature for both of you. I know, Drew, you previously directed the 828 doc, but this is your first narrative feature. So what did each of you learn about yourselves as filmmakers in making Treasure Trackers that you can take forward into future films?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wouldn't say so much was a thing I learned about myself as my own process slash the process me and Nate had developed, is that we had to learn to trust the process. We also had to be somewhat malleable because we were kind of transplanted from, you know, much smaller scale sets, shooting short films or shooting a local TV commercial, like the kind of work we had been doing, to a set where some days there's 50 people, 75 people running around. And that's just a lot bigger machine to try to do maneuver with. And so we had to figure out very quickly, how are we going to adapt our mentality and our sensibility to this bigger apparatus that we're trying to work within. And so we made a lot of adjustments even on that first day. I remember we were actually running like a couple hours behind on the very first day by lunchtime. And you had to fight off that sense of panic because everything was just going a lot slower than we were used to. And so we made some adjustments and everything kind of went without a hitch from that point on day one. But we had to learn those lessons very quickly.
Yeah, I think I agree with Drew and have the same theme, which is what I learned is to trust Drew and to trust the team that you have around you. And to, because again, Drew mentioned, we come from a smaller market. And so when we're shooting short films and stuff, you're doing everything yourself.
Right.
And once you step on set with a lot of people, you do have to learn to let go of a lot of things and then just fully own what you can own. And it's funny, we learned a lot of stuff, even going back to Knoxville for the premiere, of things we had no idea that was going on behind the scenes. So of a lot of logistical problems that had popped up and like these crazy stories and we didn't even know. And so I feel grateful for all the people we worked with who were able to handle what they did so well.
Well, job so well done, guys. You're working on another film right now?
Oh, you know how it goes. There's always something in some random stage of development.
Well, you know, I think that now that we have Treasure Trackers, a spooky film, I mean, it's good to see all year long, but it's especially good for Halloween. I think we need some adventure for Christmas.
I think you're right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we need a Christmas adventure. You can do a lot with that. A lot of things can go wrong. A lot of things can be can go right.
You're right.
Yeah.
We'll do a New Year's adventure after that.
A New Year's adventure? But, you know, you want to keep it family friendly.
We skipped Thanksgiving. Can I just point out we skipped Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, you don't want to overload your audience.
That's true.
You know, unless you actually could, and that way they could watch, oh, it's a Garcia Brothers film for Halloween. Oh, a Garcia Brothers film for Turkey Day. You know,
we just become known as the holiday directors.
The holiday directors.
Eventually doing like Arbor Day. Like, what is this?
Much akin to Tarantino's only going to make 10 movies. The Garcia brothers are trying to make a movie for every single holiday.
Well, you know,
every holiday.
You can skip Arbor Day. Hallmark has already done some for Arbor Day.
Have they done one?
I kid you not.
Oh, wow.
I kid you not. I mean, I love Hallmark. I'm addicted to Hallmark.
I love Hallmark, too. How could you not like those movies?
However, you know, it reaches a point where when you, they're publicizing, you know, Arbor Day for Arbor Day. Okay, I think, you know, that's getting a little heavy-handed there. But no, I think the two of you, you've mastered Halloween. So now I think you move on to the bigger ones. You know, you can do Turkey Day. You can do Christmas, Easter.
Oh, we mastered Halloween. Now step aside, John Carpenter.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you could even do a Valentine family film, because we don't have Valentine themed family films. Think about it.
No, it's true.
It's all adults.
That's actually a really interesting point.
You know, how cool would that be? You know, and even take it back and incorporate the old school ideas of kids, you know, the little Valentine cards in the classrooms. Be it junior high, elementary school.
You got a script?
Do we have to give you a story credit now?
Yeah, what's good?
I'll donate story credit to you, okay? I'll donate it free of charge. But no, I would love to see something like that. And I think a lot of families would like to see something like that.
I think you're right. That would be cool. Yeah. That's a great idea.
So, all right, there. I've given you something to work on. That is your homework.
Thank you very much.
That's your homework. Guys, this has been so much fun having you on the show today. I hope you're going to come back in the future, even if it's just to talk about making films in general or getting, you know, stuck and hitting brick walls. You guys are so much fun. You're so wonderful. And Treasure Trackers, it is terrific.
This is a blast.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. You have a great day. And everybody can see Treasure Trackers tomorrow.
That's right. Streaming Apple TV, Amazon, and in a bunch of territories, HBO Max.
Well, Apple, Amazon, I think, is going to work for probably 90% of the people out there. So,
there you go.
I think so.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I guarantee you, I'm probably going to watch the film yet again later in October, just because.
Perfect.
Because I like it, and it's enjoyable. So, thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Drew Garcia, Nate Garcia, talking Treasure Trackers, available tomorrow on digital platforms. You heard it on Amazon, on Apple, and check out some other digi platforms too. So that is all the time we have this week. Yes, we ran over again. You know I run over. Next week, we're in October. As promised, next week, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with Paul Reiser and Colm Meaney talking about the problem with people. And going to be joined by my friend, press colleague, Scott Hoover. Scott has written a book, Beverly Hills Noir, which is out, I think, tomorrow. Scott's going to join us next Monday, talk about the crimes of Beverly Hills that he covers in his books. And most of you, if you read People magazine, you've been watching Scott's bylines forever. Scott goes out on red carpets. Scott does the interviews and I think typically passes off to somebody else and lets them write it. But as the bylines will indicate, but a good time will be had. It's always a good time when Scott and I get together. So maybe we'll get some inside scoops. He hasn't divulged anywhere else yet on Beverly Hills Noir and the crimes of the rich and famous, including the Rat Pack. There's something for everybody. Going back to barroom brawls in the days of the Rat Pack, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin. You know, all the way up to Winona Ryder and her shoplifting. I don't think he covers Zsa Zsa and her police slap, but we'll find out next week. So, until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.